Hello and welcome to the IC Companies and Markets Show. My name's Ian Smith. I'm the company's editor of the IC. And joining me in the studio today, we have our sectors editor, Harriet Russell. How are you doing, Harriet?
Yeah, good, thanks, Ian.
Your last day before holiday, you looking forward to it?
Oh, you know, breaking free. But
breaking free in a busy day just before.
I know, we're going to get onto that.
We sure are. Everything going on in the world of retail. We also have our specialist writer, Megan Boxall. How are you doing, Megan?
I'm very well, thanks, Ian.
And you've written the cover feature this week about the NHS.
Yes, it's very exciting.
You know how to fix it.
I do.
So we're very much looking forward to that. So in this podcast, we're going to talk a lot about retail. Then we're going to talk a little bit about advertising and marketing with reference to WPP and other things going on in the advertising world. And then we're going to talk a little bit about healthcare towards the end. So let's kick off with retail. The big news today, being Thursday, was a profit warning from DFS. Didn't come out in time for us to write about it in the magazine, but it's really interesting this morning. Harriet, what is going on?
We had seen some sort of pressure starting to spiral in this kind of part of the sector for a little while now, maybe 3 or 4 months. We'd had a couple of updates from the likes of Topps Tiles, who had started to hint that they were seeing a drop off in demand. But it was sort of isolated incidents. And although Topps Tiles itself had a bit of a negative share price reaction, it wasn't something that was coming across the board. If anything, I was sort of pleased to see a lot of the retailers saying that demand was holding up this year. Well, unfortunately, DFS has turned that completely on its head this morning. Big profit warning from them. And I would say it's one of the most explicitly worded statements I've read on the issue year to date. And it has sent the shares there down by a quarter in early trading. They were down around a fifth.
It was very negative about footfall.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer people going to DFS and linked it explicitly to the macroeconomic environment and particularly the domestic political environment.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. It was one that we were debating this morning about how fair that was.
And actually, is it an excuse would be the question that John Heumann, our editor, were he here, would ask. Is this an excuse for something we knew anyway, which was the consumer economy is deteriorating?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And actually, I've had a word with Majestic Wines this morning because they've had full year results out as well. And they've been sort of hit from the knock-on effect that this particular profit warning has had across the whole sector. And the chief financial officer there, James Crawford, a very interesting point of view and one that I largely agree with, which is that in order to blame the political and thus economic sort of consequences of that, it's fair enough in a bottom line sense, because obviously the vote to leave the European Union, political decision, resulted in the significant depreciation in sterling that we've seen for almost a year now. And that has a very tangible and very obvious effect on the retailers' cost base. Most of them are importers in order to sell their products domestically. And that has a huge, huge effect on their cost base, their margins, and thus their profits. However, if you start blaming it for a top line deterioration, that becomes a little more problematic, because that implies that there is something to do with your products that is not inspiring people to spend money. And a lot of people on social media, Twitter and stuff this morning were saying, oh, you know, you can't blame Brexit, you can't blame the election. Just because there's an election doesn't mean I don't go out to the shops and buy clothes or even sofas or a new iPad or whatever it might be. That is not reason in itself. It's just that people become more discretionary with their spending and they save it and they spend it on things that they think are worth it. And that suggests to me that DFS has to kind of clear this issue up for us in the long run.
Phil Oakley, a well-known investment commentator who sometimes writes for us, tweeted, "Politics never influenced my shopping habits. If I need a new sofa and I can afford it, I buy one," which a couple of people liked. He then tweeted, after years of maxing out on credit, buying stuff they don't need, a significant proportion of our potential customers are skint. #DFS, which kind of feeds into a kind of slightly different thing about like the way that their customers buy. But I suppose what I could say back to you is that, yes, there's the political backdrop, but there's also the economic backdrop in terms of where prices are relative to where earnings are. And that's somewhere where it can have an impact on people's ability to spend and thus the top line.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is what Mr. Crawford was getting at, really, was that inflation is a real thing. You can't blame the retailers for trying to find an easy way out of that. A lot of them have had to raise prices. And yeah, I suppose that might deter people from the top line. But as Phil Oakley says, you know, just because something is £5 more expensive, if we're talking about discretionary discretionary items, which is sort of the category that DFS and other general retailers fall into, it's probably not going to be enough to turn people off shopping altogether.
We have, though, had some interesting retail stats out today, which suggest there is a wider problem.
Yeah, I mean, the wider problem is that people will still shop and they will still spend money on things, but they won't do it nearly as often or in the quantity that we've seen in the last few years post-recession. And that was really supported by data from the ONS this morning about the retail sales volumes for May, which were down. A lot of people had expected them to fall, but not this dramatically.
So the sales, yeah, down 1.6% in May. It was expected to be around 1%. Mm-hmm. It was plus 2.2% in April. Mm. Can we focus too much on monthly figures?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been one of the real bugbears of covering the sector since we voted to leave the EU last year, is that everyone has been absolutely glued to either ONS data, BRC data, any data really that's going to give us an indication of where we're at. For instance, last year, everyone was rejoicing that we had a very, very good November. The advent of Black Friday sales and things here had really sort of inspired the nation to get shopping. And that sort of dried up over Christmas. Perhaps not that unusual, because we knew that price rises were coming by this point. However, we had a fairly buoyant January sales period,
yeah,
and a fairly buoyant April. And, you know, why are people shopping in April when things are more expensive?
What we had today, I suppose, was a double whammy of the DFS profit warning, which, as you say, included very negative signs that people were looking out for to do with footfall. And we also had the ONS data that seemed to bear it out, albeit just over that month period. And we did see a big sell-off in the retail stocks, didn't we? So it wasn't just DFS that went down. Looking at it at about mid-afternoon, the second biggest faller within the clothing or general retail sectors, Dunelm, another furnishings and another retailer. Next, M Brown, Dixon Carphone, other types of retailers in there that people think really will suffer if the consumer economy is stalling.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that Mr. Crawford and I talked about at Majestic was it's fine to pull out big trends. And I think Shore Capital this morning really called it a watershed moment for retail today, which is perhaps getting a bit dramatic. I think there's an interesting sort of caveat to put on this, which is if you look at some of these big fallers, particularly people like Next and Dixon's Carphone, and certainly AO World, actually, Marks and Spencer, the common theme with all of those companies is that they have very specific problems within their businesses already. Problems that have been well flagged by this point. Some of them we've got on buy tips in a sort of contrarian sense. Some of them, like AO World, we don't. Some of them we're completely neutral on, like Dunelm. So I would really insist that readers or listeners go and look at the individual kind of buy, sell or hold cases that we have on those various stocks. It's fine to draw out trends and say, yeah, okay, this profit warning has had a huge knock-on effect on the sector, but actually that doesn't necessarily mean that going forward, which is like always the most important thing in retail, those businesses are only on a downhill slope.
There is going to be a concern, though, among our readers and listeners that, you know, which of these companies is next, in the sense that you don't have to have that much negative content in either an outlook or in a full-year trading update to really hit the shares, because people are looking so much for these kind of negative indicators. Mm-hmm. So are there any particular companies where you think, are they particularly vulnerable to a further down shift in sentiment?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to pull out individuals because anything can go wrong at any time. Majestic actually serves as a wonderful example here, because they just had a very specific mishap in the US last year, which resulted in a big profit warning for them today and a pre-tax loss reported today.
And we'll be analysing that in next week's magazine.
Yeah, we will be. So it's hard to say, oh, this person will be next, because I'm sure there are hidden profit warnings all the time that you don't see coming. That being said, I think what is possible to do is to pull out some of the more vulnerable product categories. And that is taught to us from the last recession, what did badly then and what did better. I would expect companies with sort of more discretionary items. So we're talking middle market clothing retailers. I'm going to exclude luxury, and I'm going to exclude exclude fast fashion because both of those did have done well in harder times. But yeah,
and I mean, even Jewels, and we'll come to talk a little bit about Jewels, but that's one of the only two stocks that's really in positive territory from these two subsectors that we're looking at here. I mean, it's only fractional, it's basically flat, but that's it's been a bad day for the market, so that's actually...
It's been a bad day, yeah, but I think Jewels sits at a very interesting part of the clothing sector. For me, it sits in what we generally call premium lifestyle. So we're not really talking luxury, we're not talking Burberry or Mulberry, but what we are talking about is Ted Baker Supergroup, the ones that do distinguish themselves from middle market, a little bit through price, but ultimately through product quality. And for us, that's where Jewels sits.
And you've actually included them, we can say, because it will be after markets close on Thursday, but you have included them as tip this week, Jewels.
Yes, I have. I mean, the problem with this part of the sector is that the stocks are very expensive. I've been bullish on Jewels pretty much ever since they listed. The tone of the writing has always been very positive, but trying to get into that stock has been difficult since float, and Ted Baker and Supergroup are not really exceptions to that rule either. But really, if you're trying to bet on retail this year, it's incredibly high risk. You do expose yourself to profit warnings, margin squeezes, and these are the sorts of companies that we think might be able to navigate that.
And you also mentioned fast fashion. That's an area where valuation risk is real and present. Boohoo, there's an interesting story that you've written this week talking about their new super site and more automated warehouse they're planning to build. Tell us a little bit about why that's interesting.
It's interesting because they made two very important acquisitions last year. One was a related party transaction with Pretty Little Thing, which was run by a family member, and also Nasty Gal, which was a US business that had gone into administration. And since buying those businesses, the demand has pretty much been off the charts for Boohoo. The growth numbers are just absolutely insane. They just sort of don't even bear any relation to anything else in the sector. And in order to cope with that demand, they're going to have to build out more factories and warehousing and distribution capabilities in order to serve their customers. And they'd already sort of announced investment in their Burnley site, but they're going to start this new super site, which is going to span 600,000 square feet. And I suppose the really newsworthy item about it is that they are going for a higher degree of automation, which is a touchy subject in retail, because it implies this sort of Amazon drone model that, although it's very exciting for the sort of tech people amongst us to think about a world where that is a reality, it doesn't do much for the political commentators who get on about jobs. And
but there are good jobs and bad jobs, and we've seen with the fast fashion, not Boohoo but ASOS, we've seen concerns around the conditions in some of the warehouses, and that's also been well flagged. So
yeah,
does this help Boohoo manage that risk?
I think it was definitely, it's difficult to, when I had a call with management, it's difficult for them to say anything explicitly about that. I think mainly because the allegations at ASOS and also Sports Direct are just that, they're allegations, so they're sort of limited in commenting too heavily on it. But yeah, the suggestion is definitely there that they want to avoid any sort of malpractice or corporate governance issues in that respect, and this might be one way to avoid it.
It's interesting, just to kind of round this off, that in this day of a lot of retail news, and we've been having lots of discussions about it, and you're going to be writing a story about your takeaway for the sector before you go off on holiday. But it's interesting that we've also had an intention to float from a fast fashion retailer, Quiz.
The exciting thing about Quiz is not so much what they're going to be doing, because to be honest, it's all fairly run-of-the-mill type clothing, 16 to 35 year old target market, blah blah blah. But the reason it piqued my interest is that Peter Cowgill is going to serve as their potential chairman, and people might know that name from JD Sports, where he is currently executive chairman as well.
And that should reassure, because I suppose some people that are looking at this company would say, well, they've actually got quite a large store estate, mm-hmm. and that's something potentially I don't want so much from a fast fashion retailer, and given the challenges that we've talked about with footfall and the other risks to the high street and the costs of employing people. But someone that has experience in running a high street estate effectively Could be good.
Yeah, absolutely. It hasn't held JD Sports back at all. And actually, I would direct people to a piece I wrote earlier in the year for the Sector Focus section of the magazine about this very kind of, I call it the phygital opportunity, which was sort of this marriage between online and physical store estates, which isn't anything new, except that we have generally seen it work in only one way, which is that, I don't know, someone like Next or Debenhams tries to take their business online. And what we're actually seeing more of now is the reverse, which is online retailers seeing some sort of value in having a physical store estate. It'll be interesting to get to know these guys better. I admit I don't know that much about them yet, and sort of which way round they did it, or whether they did it all at once,
or whether they can even float at all if the retail market falls off.
It's not due until July. It was an interesting day to announce their intention to float. I don't know if they knew really what was coming. I doubt it, but yeah, we'll see how that one goes. We're kind of holding off because they haven't priced it or anything yet. The only thing I do know is that the company is profitable. It makes a pretty decent cash profit, so that'll be interesting to keep an eye on.
And I just want to flag our Credit Cycle podcast that you put together, Harriet, because that's also relevant to this. The end of the consumer credit cycle is what some people diagnose, and in some ways Phil's tweet kind of speaks to that, right? People concerned that the consumer economy has been propped up by credit, and your podcast delves a lot more deeply into that and the companies that could be affected.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, it dives less deeply, I suppose, in that we actually take a much more big picture view on what is happening with the sort of macro pro factors globally, in fact, between US and China and into European banking as well, as to exactly what the vulnerability is and what could go at the top level, which would ultimately dry up at the consumer level in the UK.
Okay, fascinating. Look out for that. Megan, I want to bring you in. Now, let's move from retail to talking about advertising and marketing. WPP, the major global company within that space, always hogs the headlines. It was earlier in this month that they had their trading update, but you've done a longer analysis piece for this week's magazine talking about the investment case for the stock and how you think it's changed. To give us a bit of an overview about where you're at with WPP.
Yeah, so WPP had there was an AGM trading statement, which was, well, there was a lot of politics in there, as you might expect from Martin Sorrell.
And some strange comments. I've got some
very strange comments.
You pointed out to me, given the macroeconomic background, this is what they say in their trading update, it is not surprising that clients are generally grinding it out in a highly competitive ground game, rarely resorting to a passing game or Hail Marys.
Yeah, as a non-US sports fan, I had to ask for clarity about what that meant.
But once you'd kind of dug through the narrative, was your take?
For great reading. I mean, I'd recommend reading some of Martin Sorrell's trading statements. They're always entertaining. But he's actually quite negative, which I find very unusual for a CEO to be so negative about the sector that it's his own company's operating in. There are just so many challenges that are facing marketing and advertising companies, and WPP, as one of the world's biggest and far and away the UK's biggest, I mean, it's got no real UK competitors, is right in the centre of all those challenges.
So he talks about competition's fierce in our industry. Yeah. A lot of providers undercutting each other. He says, as some say, you are only as strong as your weakest competitor. Are they suffering from that?
Yeah, well, I find that an interesting analysis, especially when WPP has a knack of just buying its competitors. But his argument there is that marketing is a value-added proposition. And at the moment, what he's saying is that there are a few of WPP's competitors which are starting to cut costs or operate in sort of a we're going to save you money sort of way, rather than you need to invest in what we do as a value thing, which completely undermines what advertising is and what the industry has grown off. So by saying that some competitors are cutting costs, he actually says that our industry may be in danger of losing the plot if they forget about their value-added roots.
Another difficulty and theme here is the rise of social media, that businesses, if they're looking to advertise and market, can go more directly to customers and reach a huge addressable audience.
Yeah, exactly. And
without
it's addressable.
WPP.
Yeah, it's
presented.
Addressable and it's easy to use as well. I mean, Facebook ads are so much easier than what you used to do, where you were buying ad space on television or in a newspaper. It required so many more people than marketing. And what is actually the most effective type of marketing today, it's not like it's the cheapest type of marketing, Facebook or Google. It it's just the most effective, which is why people are going for it. And there is an argument that it's easy, so people won't need to even use advertising agencies anymore.
You could have an internal team,
yeah, exactly,
and then go straight to Facebook or Google.
Yeah, exactly.
But what do WPP say? Like, where do they sit?
WPP actually aren't particularly. They don't really address that as a problem. They think that they're going to be in demand regardless, and they are actually realigning their portfolio to be more digital. They're about 40% at the moment. They're aiming for higher, and it is the opinion of the wider industry, people who work in marketing, saying that actually it's very complex to run an effective ad campaign on Facebook or Google. It may be easy to just put your ad there, but to make it effective, that's harder, and that requires specialist knowledge, more specialist knowledge, and actually also specialist software, which WPP and its competitors have really been investing in as well.
So that's an argument that it's just another channel, that there's always been evolution in the channels.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and marketing, advertising being around since the dawn of humans. I mean, there's always been people.
It's always been a Don Draper.
So it's not going to go away.
But Sir Martin Sorrell is going to go away at some point, and that's something that investors are very focused on at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. After the trading statement, after the AGM last week, there were a couple of big shareholders who actually made a statement saying that WPP needs to find a successor and have a successor in place for the time Martin Sorrell, who is 72, decides to step down. And actually, their concerns are that if he decides that he wants to step down, he can just do it. He doesn't even need to give a notice period, which is why they're worried, which is fair enough. But, I mean, he seems to love it. I'd say he's going to go on forever until he absolutely can't anymore.
72 is very young these days. But I mean, having that person at the top, obviously they lost a big contract, was it last year?
AT&T and also Volkswagen.
Yeah.
Two really big contracts. But then the argument on the other hand is that it's not really Martin Sorrell who's making those contracts. I mean, he's not even an advertiser. I think he's an accountant. He is a fantastic CEO and he has built this company from wires and plastic or whatever it used to be called, but he isn't necessarily the person who's winning or losing these contracts, but he is the driving force behind WPP. But
he's kind of Roger Sterling rather than Don Draper in the analogy. He's got a lot of clients with him. No, it's absolutely fascinating. I do recommend everyone to read Megan's piece. It goes into a bit more depth and it's really absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, there are just so many challenges, and which have been flagged today as well by the fact that Sky and Virgin Media have decided to collaborate in their ad strategy, and they're going to be working together to do targeted ads, which is another thing. Targeted ads is just such a massive growth area.
And they explicitly reference social media. Yeah. Combined scale in terms of the ordinary people that they can reach rivals that of kind of social media channels.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing to say, because I mean, everyone uses Facebook, everyone uses Google for sure, and they've come up with this figure. What was it, 30 million?
Over
a long period of time. I mean, where are they plucking that figure from?
But I suppose
knows?
The basic thing is they're thinking, for us to have a compelling proposition, we need to scale up.
Yeah.
And that's the way we can kind of target in the way that you're describing the customers.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And it seems sensible. The newspapers are trying to do it as well, collaborating in the advertising market because it's so challenging. Does that create more challenges for WPP? That means one customer rather than two, if Sky and Virgin Media are both using their services before, and if the newspapers all collaborate to do their marketing together, that they're losing a lot of customers. I mean, WPP is just... it's just changing. And
sounds like another feature in the works at some point. Okay, let's move on to talk about the NHS, because I'm mindful of time. So this is the kind of subject that you can't really talk about in 10 minutes, but we're going to try anyway. What's really interesting about the context of your piece is that obviously we have this uncertain political backdrop right now, but the NHS continues to be a huge political issue, as it was in the 90s, as it's really always been when it's a crisis has been diagnosed in the NHS around the level of spending. What you've done in your piece, which I think is really useful, is stepped away from the kind of political side of things to say what is actually going on, what is the degree of private involvement in the NHS, and how might that change? So what the company is involved. Because a point you make is that there has been private involvement to extent in the NHS since its very inception.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something that sometimes people forget when they're talking about privatisation of the NHS. That is a private element to healthcare in the UK, regardless of whether or not your GP is run by an NHS trust or is run by a private provider. I mean, that throughout its history, there's been an element of independent companies operating within the NHS, which isn't...
Or even private profit.
Yeah.
Nye Bevan, when he founded it, said, "I stuffed their mouths with gold," referring to kind of consultants who were allowed to keep private practice and GPs, which could continue to be run kind of small businesses.
Yeah, so he was trying to persuade the doctors to work for the NHS, because it wasn't a very popular idea amongst the doctors.
Then a few years later, prescriptions they had to make people pay for.
Yeah, so they had to start making people... Yeah, exactly. It was 3 years before they started making people pay for prescriptions and glasses, which, I mean, looking at it now, it seems ridiculous to suggest that people didn't ever have to pay for their prescriptions. In the early days of the NHS, there are stories of people getting their wigs free on the NHS. I mean, it's crazy that... And people were taking advantage of it. And there's an argument of that that's still happening today. I mean, people overuse the doctors, for sure. And... maybe if there was an element of paying for it, that wouldn't be so much the case. But that's another whole argument. I mean, what's
fair to say is that since that point, the private sector involvement in the NHS has ramped up lots of different areas.
Yeah.
And you try and address those areas. What are ones that you found particularly interesting in terms of where private companies currently operate and where that might change?
So one that... I think the first one that is really interesting is the staffing, because it's a bit of a political topic at the moment, because the NHS is the government is in the process of selling NHS Recruiters, which is the biggest recruiter into the NHS. And it looks like it's going to be bought by Staffline, which is a listed recruiter. And I mean, it's a no-brainer for someone to want to buy this business. It's profitable. It's got a hugely fast growing revenue stream. It's got a solid revenue stream because it's paid for by the government. Why
it's got a little Brexit headache coming down the tracks potentially.
Yeah, that's true. But why the government wants to sell it, I'm not really sure, because of all the parts to sell, why sell your profitable bit? I mean, that is something that I'm not really sure I understand. But aside from that, there are so many recruiters who are already private recruiters who are already involved in helping recruit people into the NHS. It's the fifth biggest employer in the world. Mm. It's going to need help with recruitment. It's just an interesting space which seems to be looking to be slightly more independent sector involved.
And you can certainly see that increase. And another one that I thought was really interesting was property.
Yeah.
So there's already a few listed companies where you can get access to property, particularly primary healthcare, where it's badly needed to reduce the strain on hospitals.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a really great sector to be in, actually, at the moment, being a property provider to the NHS, because the government is really trying to increase the amount of, well, the scale of GP practices. Actually, they're trying to lower the amount, the number, but making them a bit more capable with responding to emergencies and just trying to take the pressure off A&Es, which, as we all know, if we've watched the news ever, the A&Es in the UK are under a huge amount of pressure. So they're trying to expand and actually make them more fit for purpose. About 40% of current GPs practices in the UK are not fit for purpose. They need to be updated. And in being updated, there is this opportunity to take so many costs out, which at the moment are crazy, how many extra costs we have, how in tech, in staff, in so many things that are not run very efficiently at the moment. And if we make our GPs practices bigger and better, we're going to be taking costs out of the NHS. But then they are private companies that are going to benefit from that, because they're going to be getting more rent from the government.
And we actually featured primary health properties in a Boardroom Talk podcast recently. Our colleague Jonas Crossland spoke to them. So do scroll down in the feed and you can
It's a really interesting company, along with its peers, which are Medics Fund and Assura. All three of them, Jonas has on a buy rating, because the same reason that Staffline wants to buy NHS recruiters. It's a great business to be in at the moment.
Now, something else that I find quite interesting is software and how software can be used to improve the efficiency of the NHS. And there's a couple of listed companies that are active there. What's your take about how actually useful these companies are to the NHS over the long term? Because obviously it's very expensive to go through transformative IT programs.
That's the thing, and that's the main issue with this whole sector. Initially, it's going to cost, and I mean, the government doesn't really have that money at the moment to be spending big on updating all of its software. But we've seen recently that the NHS needs to update its software.
Exactly.
When it got hacked, it was hacked because its software was old and because it hadn't updated the systems. Had it updated the systems, it wouldn't have been hacked. And we don't know what the costs are, but it was definitely a weekend of panic for people who needed their health checked.
And actually, we saw with Sophos, their shares rose really highly on that, as a provider of cybersecurity to the NHS.
Yeah, which I found quite unusual, because you'd have thought that when a company's, one of their company's clients is hacked, that wouldn't reflect very well on them.
But unless it's because people weren't using the latest patch, I suppose the argument goes, or that they were using, or they were using an old version of Windows, you know, which I suppose can't. But at this point, and I see that you see that with a lot of these companies. There was a secure payments company. That was saying this the other day as well. There are trends that are negative for their clients that are obviously positive for them. This is going to become increasingly important for the NHS over time as things become more digitized.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing is data sharing. I mean, that was the problem, which was why the NHS got hacked so easily. They're trying to share their data. But if they can share their data, and so the private companies again, so EMIS and Ideagen, they're two companies which are making it easier for doctors to share data, which extracts costs again. And then in larger scale technology as well, in MRI scanners, outsourcing to companies like Medica, who do the so they're radiologists, they employ radiologists, but the idea behind the technology is that it can be done really instantly. They can take their scan, they can send it out to the radiologist, who can process it really, really quickly, much quicker than it takes for at the moment, which is almost printing it off. It's a really labored experience at the moment, but using all the advances in tech, which just are phenomenal compared to how the NHS is at the moment.
That looks a bit more fundamental. You make this really good point around how inefficient it is to get a simple blood test via the NHS and the amount of different stakeholders involved in that. Yeah. And then you mentioned a couple of companies involved in helping monitor people. So ideally keeping them out of hospital if they don't need to be there, or providing a more up-to-date or immediate diagnosis.
Yeah, point-of-care diagnostics is a huge theme, and actually it's already being used in a lot of countries. In Canada, if you go for to have a blood test, they literally take your blood test there and then, and they give you the results there and then. I mean, that's one person in 5 minutes who can tell you if you've got tonsillitis or not. But when we do this in the UK, I mean, it's about a week. And then quite often on the other side of things, and that this then feeds into how much we're spending and how much we're relying on antibiotics. I mean, there are so many factors at play which can be helped by point of care diagnostics. And yeah, again, there is private companies who are developing this technology and which can help sort out some of the fundamental problems with our private health.
Well, yeah, so it's beyond debate that there are private companies that are working with the NHS. The question is, how much will that change in future? The big caveat, I suppose, is that the political backdrop, as I said, is very uncertain. Yeah. Say we had an election within the year, our major opposition party has talked about renationalising the NHS. Behind that, it seems to be around the NHS being the preferred provider for care, or perhaps stepping back from the GP commissioning. But even then, it's not been a huge amount of detail about the plans. And regardless of what kind of more stable government we have over time, there's a big funding challenge that's almost separate but connected to
this. Exactly. And so it's interesting there to how the Labour government talk about stopping using private providers for different types of care, which they are doing increasingly, and some of the private hospital providers such as Spire have been really benefiting from that. But the other way that they've been benefiting is from the amount of people who are choosing to go private and actually pay for their own treatment, because they just can't afford NHS waiting times, which are ridiculous. They've scrapped the 18-week waiting time target. We've got 3.9 million people on the waiting list.
That surprises me that isn't more of an issue, given that I'm just about old enough to remember that was an issue back in 97, and it was very much the actual waiting times was used hugely by Tony Blair-led opposition Labour Party to make their pitch for how bad a state the public services had got under Conservative government. And it's interesting that it's not higher up the agenda. Obviously, there's a lot more going on. But whatever party remains in office or gets into office, just a huge amount more money needs to go into a lot of the different parts of it.
Yeah, and I mean, where's that money coming from? The NHS spent £100 billion last year. I mean, that it's just the kind of money which is crazy. And to talk about a £2 billion or just shy of a £2 billion deficit, which is what it was last year, I mean, it doesn't really mean anything because the government is just ploughing money in as and when it needs to. It's not being run efficiently. It doesn't help to give a top-up as and when you need it. It needs to be fixed. And bring on another election. Maybe I should run for the health minister position.
A journalist going into politics, never going to happen. Okay, well, thank you so much, Megan. Thank you, Harriet. Elsewhere in the magazine this week, we have Emma Powell, our news editor, has written a really interesting feature about Turkey. We have a Bearball column looking at the Brexit talks and how they might impact on the currency markets. Elsewhere, we had Simon Thompson running through a number of small cap investment opportunities, so do look out for that. All of that and more in All Good News Agents, £4.90. See you next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.